May it please the court. My name is Sam Carson, and I'm here on behalf of Appellant Grand Thornton LLP. This is an appeal for the denial of costs by the Federal District Court after a remand to this court. I'd like to break cost down into two pieces. First, when the case was before this court, pursuant to Rule 39, issued an order, which is found in the record, which awarded Grand Thornton $7,000 in costs. The district court denied those costs as well. That was error for the reason those costs were ordered by this court, and there was really nothing left for the court to do other than follow the mandate. The costs were in the mandate. The way the costs work under Rule 54, they're then put into the judgment. The court did not award those $7,000 that the court should have. The rest of the award that Grand Thornton sought pursuant to either Rule 39E or Rule 54. That is discretionary. However, costs are to be presumptively awarded, and as this court held in Sherry, costs are to be denied only when there is something which has an element of injustice. And this court in Sherry, which is the court's most recent pronouncement on the applicable law, stated two grounds for which costs could be denied. One, whether was misconduct by the prevailing party. There was none here, as the district court below found, or that there is an inability to pay on the part of the losing party. Now, the judge below made some statements about the fact that Mr. Ellis was a person, a message of modest means. That is simply insufficient to show an inability to pay.
I think, counsel, you make a fair point that there's a difference between the Sherry standard, which is inability to pay, and what the court focused on, which is more scraping financial terms. I wonder, though, if that doesn't elevate form over substance somewhat to send it back to the district court, who would then simply find inability to pay.
Well, I would hope the district court would not be inability to pay. This court announced the standard of inability to pay. I will confess that standard has been fleshed out more by other circuits. We cited the Seventh Circuit in Rivera, the Eleventh Circuit in Chapman, and the Third Circuit in Paola, if I hope I pronounced it correctly. In all three of those circuits, the courts have applied the same standard and have indicated to make a showing of an inability to pay, there must be something in the record, preferably by affidavit. As Moores also points out, a drop in income does not show an inability to pay. And as the court held in the 11th Circuit most clearly in Chapman, now it's not an all or nothing. It may be that somebody could not pay $60,000, but they could pay $10,000. So in deciding whether or not cost should be permitted, the question is not, is it all or nothing? It's whether something should be permitted in terms of cost. So I would hope that when there was a full factual record, if this court were to remand, that was a request by the appellee, but would be opposed, if the court were to do that, there would be then a factual record, and the district court then would have to make a determination as to whether or not Mr. Ellis would pay some, all, or nothing. But the standard really is, as all the other circuits have indicated, this must be a factual predicate for that determination. And there was here. I mean, he had made $200,000 in the past. That was in the record. He had other benefits in addition to $200,000 per year as a bank president. It is true that at the time that he retired, he was making close to $42,000 a year. But what the assets were, no, it's not in the record. I don't know. What his other ability to pay was, I don't know. All I knew was income was at a particular point, and that was not a sufficient predicate. And I think if one throws out that predicate, which one must do under Sherry, then the denial of costs cannot stand. The only other basis that the court used below was closest and difficulty of the case. That has been held by a district judge in this district in the case of the Western panel, that difficulty in the case is not a reason alone to deny cost award. this is actually an interesting issue because the circuits are sort of a little bit split a little bit in terms of how much weight one can give to a difficulty of a case. There's two cases cited in our brief, Paola in the Third Circuit, and there's a case called Klein in the Tenth Circuit, where they hold that difficulty of a case is not a reason to deny costs. This court in Cherry mentions it, but I have to confess, reading the opinion about six times now, it's not entirely clear how the court used that fact. And I say that because if one reads the opinion, it states there's two grounds for denial, misconduct or an inability to pay. It then says there are other factors. And when one recognizes that an inability to pay does not mean you don't award costs, it only means it's discretion on the part of the district judge to not award costs, a point made very clearly by the Seventh Circuit Rivera. Then you have to look at other factors. And one factor that one might look at would be the difficulty of the case. Moore says it's not enough of a loan to deny it. A couple of other circuits even suggest, Third Circuit Paola suggests that it's really not even a factor. And I guess the reason for that would be we step back because historically what costs were for. It's interesting because the legal rule in the United States was costs are always awarded. The equitable rule was they're never awarded except in the discretion of the court. And then when the rule was adopted, Rule 54, it became an amalgam of both. So there's a presumption that you award costs because attorney fees and other fees are usually not awarded. And then there is a discretion on the part of the district judge in certain bounds, which cannot be transversed, to deny costs. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I believe not, Your Honor, if I might say so. He lists various factors, including closeness of case. If one reads Cherry deals with that factor in E, but it lists it after the two-part test. This is in head note 4 of the opinion. In fact, what it says is other factors. You recognize additional factors to justify denying an award of cost, such as, and it lists the factors. As I have it interpreted, Cherry, what I think it says is that you need the first two to be satisfied, and then these other factors can come into play to justify an award. So I think that, yes, the key factor is carried over in Cherry, but only as an additional factor. Speaking to the judge who wrote the opinion on appeal, a question like that is hard for me to know, but I will say no. And I will say no because I think it was a purely legal issue of whether or not there was a duty. And while the district judge concluded there was a duty, I don't think that there was or there wasn't. But I'll go on to say that I don't think he says that close, even taking he by itself, he does not say that closeness in and of itself is a reason to deny costs, which was precisely the point that Judge Michael made in Virginia Panel Court, which the case from the Western District of Virginia we cited in our briefs. He dealt with he, and he said, Paola and Klein. Yes, Your Honor. The only case interpreting Teague is the district court in Virginia Tavern. There are other circuits which have held that closeness is not a ground in and of itself to deny costs. And those cases are Ayola from the Third Circuit and Klein versus Grinberg from the Tenth Circuit.
Is there language in Teague that expressly says that the closeness of the case can trump inability to pay in terms of rebutting the presumption of awarding costs to the prevailing party?
No, I don't. I think that Teague does not confront that issue. I think that Teague used a variety of three or four factors in affirming the discretion of the district judge. I don't think, and I think that it is Cherry that really deals more directly with the issue of whether there's an inability to pay. Because Cherry goes on also to say that the comparative wealth of the various parties is not a reason at all for a denial of costs. I don't think that he really deals directly with this issue as does Cherry.
Counsel, your point may be well taken that Cherry fleshes out the question of what is inability to pay and how it should be viewed. But as Judge Hamilton questioned you, he certainly deals with the issue of closeness. So in this case, let's assume you're correct that it does not meet the standard of Cherry in terms of finding the ability to pay. But since there is closeness, you didn't quite concede that yet, but I think even though you're advocating, you'd have to say this is a close case. Closeness, it wouldn't just be closeness alone. Wouldn't it be closeness plus some evidence of income challenge? By the way, it may not meet the standard of ill pay because it didn't get into it, but you see a lower income. So it wouldn't be just alone. It would be that and a factor of diminished income, wouldn't it?
Well, I would suggest not. I think
why not?
Because the test is there really is there inability to pay?
That's one. That's one.
Test. But if you don't miss that, that's the test that deals with the issue of whether or not there should be a denial of cost. So then if you don't miss that test, then the question is the closest. And yes. I thought as a matter of law, there was no duty under West Virginia law in the West Virginia Supreme Court case. So I don't think that there was closeness. It's going to be, I appreciate that two members of the panel that heard the case are sitting, are in front of me. And whatever I say on that issue, it's just, you know, the court has its own views on that. I appreciate that. So I think the next question is closeness in and of itself enough? And that's not the basis of the district court's decision below. And I'm not aware of a case in the United States. I think it's really not a case in the briefs, anyway, that says that closeness in and of itself is enough of a reason to overcome the presumptive denial of costs.
You recognize, though, that the district court lived with this quite some time and found on the basis of his familiarity with the relationship between the parties that, in his words, having to pay costs in this amount would work up the state's culture. So you do recognize that there is some financial pressure that exists in addition to the relative legal merit of it. You have to acknowledge that. I think maybe your stronger argument, which I think is where you started out, is that it may not support the all or nothing, but don't you have to acknowledge that the correctness of the district court finding that having to pay the amount that was set would work with the state's culture?
Well, I guess I have to say that, but you need to explain why. I think that pay some of money when you are a plaintiff or an individual is always going to be a hard. This court very recognized that in fact one of the digital plaintiffs is not a reason of itself to deny costs. I will concede the fact that as an individual paying $60,000, it can always have some effect on you that you would not want to have. How big an effect on it that would have on an individual, one cannot tell from this record. And as Your Honor indicated, I think it's not a justification to say no cost at all. I mean, and sum up, I mean, I think that what is different about this case is the fact that this is talking about a bond. And there was a strategic choice made to require my client to put up a bond. And that was what we asked, and a bond was required. And it seems that from a matter of policy, if people are going to be putting up a bond to protect themselves against a portion of the judgment pending the vindication of their rights on appeal, that it's concomitant, fair, and equitable on the other side for the bond cost to be awarded, at least in part.
Thank you, Counselor. Mr. Bill?
I want to thank you for your remark. It has been my privilege to represent Mr. Ellis for 12 years. Since 1999, he's been collects. Today, I'm here to ask the court to affirm Judge Faber's reasoned, consistent, and justified opinion that costs, in this case, should not be awarded because there would be an element of injustice in doing so. Yes, sir. I understand that, Your Honor, and I have to apologize to the court. I didn't see that issue in the briefs. I believe that is the law of the case. Judge Faber did, in fact, set them aside and concluded that the total was the amount that it would be unjust and where there would be an inability to pay. It wasn't briefed. I don't even think Mr. Carson split it out in his petition. So I haven't researched it, Your Honor, but if it is in fact the law of the case, then that is the order, this court, of course, can order that we pay that amount.
It wasn't really even within the district court's jurisdiction to get this. It wasn't properly before.
I understand that, Your Honor. I accept that,
yeah.
Your Honor. It was an issue that we didn't brief, isn't here. I accept everything that you're saying about that. Two main points to my argument, Your Honor. Judge Faber followed this court's mandate in Cherry. He considered factors that Cherry allows district courts to consider. He made the wholly unremarkable conclusion that to ask a person to pay in costs an amount that exceeds his annual income of any year in this century for a man who is now retired and has no prospects of earning more in the future, I don't think that's an unremarkable, that's a common sense conclusion about inability to pay. Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, what's interesting to me about that in this case is it came from trial testimony. Most of the cases that involve affidavits or additional evidence about balance sheets arose after summary judgment and arose after district court. That's the case with Cherry, and that's the case with most of the cases cited, except for Teague and Paoli. The trial court had an extensive record in this case about income. There was nothing for either one of us, either party, to argue about assets specifically, although, and the court doesn't have the entire trial record before it, there was a forensic accountant's workup and there was consideration of the stock he owned in the bank. That element is, in fact, missing, and that's true, Your Honor. I didn't see that element in Teague. Teague arises out of a trial where the trial court judge and this court looked at a trial record, concluded, and it's a fascinating case because of all the other issues in it, but they concluded that the plaintiffs were persons of modest means who bought these vacation interests from Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. There's no real discussion of what those means were. There's no real discussion of what the costs saw were.
It was interesting. I mean, Steve really didn't, and it was a slightly different circumstance in that the court was concerned about the differing financial circumstances among defendants.
There was concern about the different financial circumstances among defendants. The court in Teague also, in its footnote, awarded costs in one case because of the closeness of the case. What strikes me about it and why I think Judge Faber's ruling should be affirmed is that the basic facts of this case, which are that $68,000 in costs exceed Mr. Ellis's income and he is no longer employed, it ought to be enough.
That is certainly an argument, and I respect that, and I certainly respect the district court's familiarity with that case. The problem is, as Judge Hamilton's question suggests, it's awfully hard to review on appeal when the sum total of the district court finding is yearly salary of $52,000. It is therefore clear that having to pay costs in this amount.
Correct.
For a couple of reasons. One is, I don't have any sense of what other assets are brought to bear. And second, I have no way to know whether or not costs in some lesser amount might not have been paid. $5,000 opposed to $50,000. And there is no analysis before me that I can review to make such a determination.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I too wish that if there had been an analysis of that in the trial, then that would be in the trial court record for the court to look at. As you also know from reviewing the briefs, that by the time the bill of costs was awarded, Mr. Ellis' health problems had gotten to the point, given the short time frame, that I was unable to submit anything with that. My response to that motion in the district court. Well, I raised the issue with the district court about whether health issues are a factor that would justify finding an inability to pay. You have no record on that as well. And the court needs to understand, and I know it's outside the record, but I'm dealing with a client who's developed dementia. And I can get answers from other people. If the case is remanded for more facts, I will have to go to other people for those facts. So for all those reasons and understanding the problems and what is not in the record, I think the facts that Judge Faber relied upon are consistent. We cited another case in our brief that Judge Goodwin wrote, finding that asking someone to pay even half of her income was a sufficient reason in and of itself for denying costs. And most of the cases also, Judge, and involve costs of $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. This is an enormous sum, and I think that's why Judge Faber concluded that on this record, this was enough.
But a lesser sum might have been appropriate.
He could.
That's all I'm saying. I think we both are struggling with the cost of these.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I wish we were all swimming in a different pond on that issue. The second issue, of course, is the difficulty and closeness of the case. And the court has addressed this. Judge Hamilton, you asked earlier about Teague. I do think that's controlled by Teague. I think Teague, in fact, in drawing a distinction between awards of costs against different defendants there based solely on that factor, made that important. I also think that this circuit's approach to this issue, which has one prerequisite, the plaintiff, that the person seeking relief from costs of acted in good faith, and then directing district courts to consider these other factors. I don't agree with Mr. Parsons' analysis that an inability to pay is also a prerequisite. Paoli, for example, deals with that circuit's issues about indigency. And indigency and inability to pay anything is different from this court's inability to pay analysis. So I think this court's jurisprudence permits the district court can articulate a good reason for doing so to, once they have found that the person seeking relief acted in good faith, to consider any of those factors, and no particular weight is given to them, and if the reason is good enough, to avoid an injustice, can relieve a party of paying the cost. And for those reasons, I would urge you, yes, ma'am. Enormously, Judge. And, of course, you know that from reading the record in this case. I can tell you from my position as the advocate, and I started in this in 1999 when Mr. Ellis was first the subject of a grand jury investigation that arose out of the collapse of Keystone. This case was enormously close and enormously difficult. It had issues involving unavailable witnesses. It had criminal trials going on. It had securities claims. It had the claims of the FDIC. It had Mr. Ellis's claim. It had experts in complicated areas of accounting and auditing negligence. The trial itself, just in front of a judge, went on for days. The ramifications of this, and as counsel for Mr. Ellis himself, we had to deal with all of that interplay through trial. Judge Faber handled very difficult and complicated issues arising out of all of those factors. I think it was, I guess if you ask if it was close, I didn't think it was close. I thought Mr. Ellis's, the judgment Mr. Ellis received was clear and appropriate. The issues are subtle. The interplay between responsibilities of an auditor to a board, between responsibilities of an auditor to an incoming president, timing, drafts of documents at different periods of time. It was an enormously close, difficult, and challenging case. There is no way, if the abuse of discretion test means that no reasonable person could disagree, I don't think any person could, and there aren't very many reasonable people who could disagree with the proposition that this case is very close. Very close. And that's your fact. And for those reasons, and understanding that the standard of review is abuse of discretion, I think all of Judge Faber's findings that Mr. Ellis acted in good faith, that he had an inability to pay $68,000 since he was no longer working and hadn't made that much in the last 10 years, and that the case was close and difficult, were sufficient for this court, and in fact, require that this court affirm. And further, the affiant saith not.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Mr. Parson, you have reserved some time.
Thank you.
At first, the district judge, I will point that on a page 90 of the record. We did tell the district judge that this court had ordered the fees of $7,000. Therefore, there was absolutely no discretion involved. And those fees were still, the costs are still not ordered by the district judge. This court has indeed said that the standard of governance is an abuse of discretion standard subject to two things. One, there's a presumption for an award of costs, and two, there must be injustice to deny an award of any costs. And the court below must go ahead and stay within the definition of the bounds of things that properly can be considered. I do not dispute that it was good faith by the plaintiff, but as this court held in Perry, that's a prerequisite for a court to even decide whether or not cost should be awarded.
But you do know that Perry can't overrule Higgs.
Yes, Your Honor.
But to the extent that Perry undermines or somehow changes it, can't do that. It certainly can elaborate on it and give more detail, but it, but until preceded Terry, correct? All right, but then that's still precedent. It wasn't an en banc court sitting in chair.
No, I do get that.
Right. So then the factor that they looked at, considering in terms of ability to closeness, is still in play. Now, it may elaborate more on chairs and we gave way to it, but it's still a factor. And as you put out the abuse of discretion, is not looking at someone's income an appropriate thing to look at? Is it not? Is looking at one's income appropriate to look at?
I would say not.
Not?
No.
My goodness, how would you not? How would that not be a factor to see how much income a person has in determining ability to pay for hardship? Tell me how you come to that conclusion.
It would have to be a factor. It might. I think maybe you want to say it wouldn't necessarily be wrong. You can't possibly say it wouldn't be wrong.
If somebody paying the cost of work would truly work a great hard job, so somebody really cannot afford to pay, I agree that is a factor. Perry says that is a factor. I think that any cost of work that somebody is asked to pay, an individual, will work some hardship because it's taking money from the individual. That kind of a hardship. Not sufficient. I do not think that Sherry overrules the. I think what Sherry does do is sort of explicate the factors that were being considered, in T.
And also, is the economics of relativity important? The fact that you were making $300,000 and it dropped to that cost, is that also a factor in terms of one economic picture? Is that a factor?
I think it's a practical one figure on the picture, but as Moores deals specific with that issue and says that a drop in income is not something that justifies a denial of fees because what one needs to do is to look at the total picture. Because if one income goes from $50,000 to $30,000, but one has $8 million in assets, it should not be a factor. One goes from $50,000 to $30,000, and one has no other assets, then it should be a factor. Without knowing what are the other assets.
But there's no evidence in this record that there are any assets like that in here, correct?
Well, I agree. There's nothing in the record, Your Honor. That was the burden. The presumption that the cost to be awarded, and if costs are not to be awarded because of the financial condition of one of the parties, then there should be something presented through the record. So that is a predicate for that decision. Look, I will confess that if Mr. Ellis was only making $40,000 before he retired, and he had no assets at all, to deny a word of cost, perhaps except for a small amount, within the bounds of discretion. If he had, he's making $200,000 a year before he made the $40,000 a year. There's nothing in the record as to how much money that when his assets he still had when he was making $50,000 a year. And that, I believe, in Sherry requires that kind of a predicate, and the other circuits that have dealt this issue have required that type of a predicate. That's what I'm saying. And then it turns out that there are few assets, that only a small cost reward based upon the bond could be made, so that then is something that's supported by the past.
Let's ask this question in terms of abuse of discretion. Let's say found that he was making the income that the court looked at, and he had a $200,000 home that he was living in. And do you think it would be abuse of discretion to say, well, he's only making $42,000. He has a $200,000 home, but he has to pay a mortgage, and I'm not going to factor in. I still say hardship. Would that be an abuse of discretion, even if he had a $200,000 home?
He had a $200,000 home.
Yeah.
And no other assets. I think it would be an abuse of discretion to make an award of nothing.
Really? Why?
Because I think that given what his financial condition was, that he can afford to pay something off.
So you'll make him liquidate his home?
I thought he was making $40,000. I thought he had an income of $40,000 in addition to the
$200,000. I did. So he said, liquidate his home. Well, I'll pay something.
Okay, something.
So you're following the peppercorn rule. So even if a person was on welfare, you could, it's hard pressed to say they couldn't afford a dollar, correct? So there would be abuse of discretion if the court didn't find all the way down to $2.
Well,
wouldn't you agree that even a person on welfare could pay $2, right? Wouldn't you have to agree with that? I mean, it would be.
I would agree with that. I think that. Well, then, the $2 would not be abuse of discretion. But let me say this. I mean, and obviously, well.
Obviously, what?
In Sherry. Obviously, the court's not kind of agreeing with what I'm saying. But I mean, in Sherry, what this circuit held is that the informer of Harper's plaintiff, even though you're in form of Harper's, which means you do not have a lot of money because of the costs in this circuit. And I understand that in most situations, if you're in form of Harper's, and a cost award is not,
Well, I think you make a fair point. The difficulty on these facts is I've lived with this a little too, and the stages of this are considerably longer. One thing that I find significant here is that it's precisely the fact that the district court has lived with this case long enough to have been able to develop a sense of the parties' financial circumstances. Even though the finding is a great deal to do that.
And I understand that. And I think that in terms of I guess it's correct. There was not submitted. No, Your Honor. I think that the cost of something was awarded. I think Mr. Ellis preferred to provide that evidence. That, at least for the other circuits that specifically dealt with this issue, have held in this burden. I mean, to be candid as well, one reason. I believe the way the cost procedure works, FERC cost acts with these. The FERC acts with these and just awarded the fees for cost for import. There's then 5 days by which there must be a response opposed to the act. I think that the way that procedure works, deemed to be working based on evidence affidavits, I think that the inability to pay is a factor which the non-winning party has the burden of going forward on. The other circuits that have dealt with this have talked about affidavits coming from the non-winning party. If one reads the brief below, though, one will also see that the point was not made that I cannot pay. It was more made in terms of a comparative wealth of the two parties in the case. So, you know, now Judge Faber, following Sherry, went more off on the Sherry route in terms of inability to pay. But one looks at the briefs that led up to that decision. One does not see the inability to pay argument being made that way by Mr. Ellis. I think. what Grand Court did was made a decision not to seek any of the costs that had been incurred at the district court level, but what it thought was costs that had been incurred at the appellate court level. And no, Your Honor, what Grand Court asked for was costs. Didn't they ask costs to give some portion? Just that this is the cost award, and the clerk packed the cost, and then it went up and a motion set aside. But if Your Honor's asking, did Grand Court say, give us half the cost based upon his financial condition? The answer is no. But frankly, when the papers were being briefed, the statement wasn't being made, we cannot afford to pay. It was more in terms of, he was making $50,000 a year presently, but there was not a suggestion made at the time, and the briefs were in the record, that there was an inability to pay. So, yes. Yes, it's going two things in the cost runner. $60,000 was the bond, and that $1,500 was the transcript that was used in the appeal. Those are the only two items thought. I mean, there was a decision made not to seek any of the other costs at the district court level. The only cost that were thought was the bond and the transcript. And the reason why my client felt strongly about the bond was because the bond had been, he said, don't ask for a bond. And they said, you have to put up a bond. And they felt that if you can make me put up a bond and I lose, you should pay then for the cost of the bond. And I'm not aware, actually, of the case. And it's actually, if you look at Rule 39, there's cases where bond issues have come up, which I recognize during the argument, where a bond has been denied. Cost of the bond.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Bale, you come up to the podium. Mr. Fraser, please remain. We have a rich and wonderful tradition of the Fourth Circuit, the Greek Council. Our technology challenges that tradition. Judge Hamilton is not here. I was tossed between having him put his palm up and you could high-five the screen or extend his arm and you extend one. But I think I'm going to settle with both of you stand at the podium and let Judge Hamilton greet you both first. Then Judge Duncan and I will come down and greet you. Judge Hamilton? Thank you. We'll come down to Greek Council and we'll proceed to the next case.